All right, welcome back to one of the coldest days on record here, it feels like. Minnesotans have a word for the type of weather that we have outside. Anybody from Minnesota or Michigan, anywhere that area, you know what they call the kind of weather we have outside right now? Yeah, early summer. So this one, so we had wrapped up our little short ad hoc series on identity. If there are any follow-on questions, because at the end, as usual, I was a terrible manager of time and it was really jammed up. So if we have any questions from that we want to do, we'll absolutely entertain those now. This will basically be a Q&A class. We've got two questions that were submitted via the Facebook comment page, or the Facebook page that had allowed comments on that thread. Thread? What do you call it? Post. And then any questions that we want to ask too. So one of the, I'll throw the questions that we had out for everybody's knowledge, and then we can address whichever ones you want first. But some of these I'd like to address together, because I actually think corporately we have the data to answer some of these questions, but it'd be good to see what we come up with thinking-wise. But one of them, if I can summarize it quickly, is basically what should church look like? And that's a short way of asking the question. The question asker is in, so if he wants to expound on it, he can. What should church? No, I'm using a particular version. There's a kind of English that has originated solely in the South. Right. What should church? I was leaving some space over here. talking and writing, same.
I think you were going to say, what should church like church to look like?
Church likes church to look like. Well, it is notable that the, yes, correct. So what should church look like is one question. And really, I think the reason we ask that question is sometimes we look in the Bible and we see church looking, or what we call church today, looking very differently than we do now. And then, of course, if you go around now and you look at, go from one church to another, especially if you go from some of the major divisions. You go from an Orthodox church to a Catholic church to a Protestant church to a Pentecostal church to a Presbyterian church. You start to say there's such vast differences in the way we do business, church-wise or formally. Is somebody right and is somebody wrong? Because obviously if there's a right way to do church, we feel like we want to do that too. Okay. The second question was, actually, is an interesting one to me because it goes to a word study, a single word study, so it's not too long. But there's a verse in Steve. What was the reference? Second. Oh, Colossians 2. Yeah. What are elemental spiritual forces? And the reason that this one is actually one that I think that we can all answer even looking at it today, but it has some key implications, which is why I assume why Steve's asking the question for the passage that's in there. And that's in Colossians 2:20, I think is where it's used. So that and any other questions we want to get to, we will get to. So why don't we start with the second question first, and then we'll go to the first one, because the first one has the possibility of going really long, and maybe we roll it over into another class too, although I guess technically the second one too. But let's look up Colossians 2:20, and somebody do it, while somebody read it, and while they're looking it up and reading it, somebody else look up. I've recommended BibleHub.com as a thing to do. Go to BibleHub.com, pull up this exact verse, and you'll see an INT tab or a three-letter there that you can click on, and that will break it out into the Greek. And you'll see the exact word in the Greek that we're talking about. And then when you click on that word in Greek, it'll also take you to all the other places that that word's used in the Bible. This is a very helpful way to do Bible study, I think. So I'll give you a little bit of when people ask questions, how I go about looking up, or if I have questions myself, how do I go about trying to learn more about it rather than just do what we're tempted to do a lot of times, which is just read it and say, well, I think this word means X. Well, it certainly does in English, but there are many possibilities that could have been put into in English, and you're maybe missing some of those too. So, all right, so somebody read Colossians, maybe in context, read kind of the whole paragraph or a paragraph before it type of thing.
I'll start at verse 16. Therefore, do not let anyone judge you by what you eat or drink, or with regard to a religious festival, a new moon celebration, or a Sabbath day. These are a shadow of the things that were to come. The reality, however, is found in Christ. Do not let anyone who delights in false humility and the worship of angels disqualify you. Such a person also goes into great detail about what they have seen. They are puffed up with idle notions by their unspiritual mind. They have lost connection with the head, from whom the whole body, supported and held together by its ligaments and sinews, grows as God causes it to grow. Now this is verse 20. Since you died with Christ to the elemental spiritual forces of this world, why, as though you still belong to the world, do you submit to its rules? Do not handle, do not taste, do not touch. These rules, which have to do with things that are all destined to perish with use, are based on merely human commands and teachings. Such regulations, indeed, have an appearance of wisdom, with their self-imposed worship, their false humility, and their harsh treatment of the body, but they lack any value in restraining sensual indulgence.
And maybe I'm wrong. This right here, this passage he just read could be the study of weeks. It is extremely profound, potentially in its implications. So maybe both of these are really good questions. Maybe we won't get to any other ones, but we'll kind of go from here. So first, what questions do we, before we get into the meat the specific kind of hermeneutics and the looking at this, the specific word meanings and what their context might be and how they were used at the time and how they're used now, those kinds of textual criticism type of things, what questions jump out at you? And obviously, Steve, you get the first vote of what questions jump out because you must have asked it for a reason. But what questions jump out at you? Like, why do you want to know what does this mean? Why is it important to know what this means?
I would like to know how does it work when, I think I have kind of an idea what it means, but I don't know how it means actually.
Okay.
So
he's got kind of an idea what it means, but it's sufficiently vague that knowing what it actually means would fill in a lot of data. What ideas do you think we might be gleaning from this passage? What kinds of things might it be saying, depending on of course, what this means? Now, and I do want this one to be more discussion-based, if we can. I mean, as an example, I'll give you one example. So, it seems like Paul is saying, do not handle, do not taste, do not touch. Why do you submit to regulations? It's almost like Paul's asking this question. Why are you following the law at all? And now, as Christians, we think at least now today why we don't, we still can eat pork maybe, or we don't wash our hands a certain way before we eat, or we don't, if we touch something that has mold on it, we don't stay unclean until evening, and we don't have to walk on a particular side of the street and tell people we're unclean and stuff like that. So I think we know why we don't follow those kind of laws. But what if do not handle, do not taste, and do not touch refers to another man's wife, another woman's husband? Is that what he's saying too? So one of the questions we want to answer, because he's talking about all things that have to do with flesh. He's talking about spiritual versus worldly stuff. So half of me wants to know, is he saying you don't have to follow any part of the law, or why are you even considering following part of the law? So that's one thing that immediately jumps to me, which is why I want to know what that means. But then he says, these indeed, in 23, he says, these do have an appearance of wisdom in promoting self-made religion and asceticism and severity to the body, but they're no value of stopping the indulgence of the flesh. So you can see he thinks the indulgence of the flesh is bad. So where's Paul? You know, the real question here, I think, is being asked in here is, where is the line drawn? And I think that where is the line drawn actually is going to be the question that we want to ask here, and it's going to have multiple meanings. One of them, I think, will surprise you. So one of them, what meaning are we thinking about? Obviously, just by the stuff I mentioned, what kind of lines are we talking about there?
Moral
lines, right. Where do we draw the moral lines? One of the major questions at the time, we all know, was, does one have to become Jewish in order to become Christian? That was a Those who said so were called, in the scriptures, the Judaizers, which, not a pejorative term, more like, no, the path, the way that Christ, the Messiah taught was, you have to be a good Jew, but this is what being a good Jew looks like. Because that was the way that salvation was brought to people at the time. People could convert to Judaism and worship God. The other way to do it is, no, you don't have to be a Jew. You can go straight kind of into the kingdom of heaven. That seems to be what Paul recommends. So in following, in being obedient to God, obedience to God is usually cast in moral terms. Now, he uses another term in there. What term does he use in between 20 and 23? These have an appearance of
wisdom,
right. So what's the line between wisdom and foolishness? If in the Old Testament you could see that those who followed the law and were obedient to God were called wise, and those who didn't listen to God were called foolish, the moral implications, where the moral line is drawn, is probably going to inform where the line of wisdom is drawn, and we all want to be wise rather than foolish. Now, before I even ask the third question, let's go and look up that word, elemental, so the one that's translated, elemental spiritual forces or elemental things. Who has pulled up the interlinear portion of Bible Hub, and what's the Greek word? Anybody got it yet?
I don't see it on here, actually.
Yeah, I have Bible Hub, I just can't find.
You have to pull up, this is a bug, not a feature, I think. You have to only pull up the one verse. So if you're looking at it in context, you won't get this menu, at least on the mobile version of it. And I think you don't get it on the full laptop or desktop version either.
I can read what I see here.
Okay.
It says, if you have died with Christ away from the principles of the world, why, as if living in the world, do you submit to decrees?
Right. So another word there is decrees. So this gives us an idea of elemental spiritual forces is one translation. Another one is decrees. So if you go in the mobile version of Bible Hub, where you're only, the way I do it is, if you just go to Google, search bar, whatever your favorite search engine is, and you put in the verse only. So the whole verse, so not just Colossians 2, you put in Colossians 2:20. One of the returns, usually fourth or fifth return down, will give you Bible Hub. And then it'll give you this screen right here, which along the top, you'll see all the different translations they have. So what Peter's doing is, you can, if you want to kind of get an initial sample, just scroll through these. You can see what the NIV is, or as Reformed theologians call it, the non-inspired version. The New Living Translation, which is sort of a translation. English Standard Version, which is the right one if you're Reformed, right? It's the official approved by John Calvin, even though he had to come back to life in order to do so. So they have all these great, including King James, and some ones that you don't normally see. So it'll give you a little bit of a sense of how English translators of multiple theological bases have translated these things. Because what you'll find sometimes is that people's theological basis influences which interpretation they use. Not maliciously, but they, you know, if you know God as love, and you could translate one other word meaning God loves somebody, or God hated somebody, that let's say that word could mean either one. You're knowing that God is love, and it talks about God, you're probably going to assume that it means love. That doesn't actually exist anywhere, but I'm just using an example. So then the next thing you can do is the second bar, sets of bars down, have P-A-R, S-E-R, T-O-P, S-T-R, all that kind of stuff. I-N-T, which is about two-thirds of the way across, at least in my screen, is interlinear. And that'll actually show you several lines. One of these lines has the Greek transliteration on the top, so how you would pronounce it in English. Then they've got the actual Greek if you want to be fancy, and you can write it yourself sometimes down in your notes, so that people who pick up your notes occasionally look at them and are like, wow, this person's really smart, even though you don't know what it means, nor do I. And then the English translation is below it. And let's go to where principles in this version, because I think I have the NIV up here. So principles is the same one that was elemental spiritual forces. And you'll see at the top stoichion, or however it's pronounced in the more ancient term. But stoichion is up right above the term principles. And if you click on stoichion, you'll see where it's used in Colossians, and it gives you the different versions of it. And why am I not getting what I'm looking for here? Oh. Yeah, it is the case that... so then if you go right above that, you can get the concordances, translations of that, etc. But there's one limitation here that I want to explain as well. When it only pops up one verse used somewhere, when you click on the actual Greek word, what it's telling you is it's only used one place in the Bible. Now, the root word is used several places in the Bible. So in this case, this version of the word is only used once, but the root of stoikion, which my Greek is terrible, it's non-existent, but I don't remember what form this is and what other forms are used in there. But if you put that term, stoikion, back into a search engine, it'll kick you out a whole bunch of discussion and other verses of where it is. So it's a little bit of work to do so, but what you'll find is, at least from, I don't read anything, I don't read Greek, I don't understand Greek, but I try to go back to it occasionally and see where else it has been used. So as an example, the root word of this and this word in this form is used a lot in Plato, Aristotle, the ancient Greek philosophers, the pre-Socratic philosophers. They all talk about this one. In fact, it's one of the most important words they use. How do they mean it? So if you want to answer that for yourself, pull that word, stick it in your search engine, and go kind of read through all the different things, trusting the internets as you're supposed to in different places and verifying it and all that kind of stuff. But what you'll find is this has been added by the translator. There is the normal Greek usage of the word is not one that talks about it in specifically spiritual terms. It can mean part of the world that is spiritual, but the actual translation of the word, stoikion, has to do with the fundamental reality. That which is what we would call, if you want to know what the stoikion is of our universe, our physical universe, the answer is matter and energy, or whatever that most fundamental version of it is. So the people who kind of first used it in the ancient Greek philosophy, philosophers that used it most, were the atomists, the people who said, no, the world does break down into something elemental, something basic, something that is a thing, a type of thing on its own. It's the most fundamental form of matter that's out there, stoikion. So if that's what this means, now read Colossians 2:20 again, and instead of using elemental spiritual forces, say and place that with the fundamental construct of reality, physical reality. Fundamental construct of physical reality.
Okay. If you have died with Christ away from the fundamental construct of physical reality,
right,
of the world, why, as if living in the world, do you submit to decrees? That's a weird translation.
Isn't it? Or let's say, try to replace it with matter and energy.
Since you died with Christ to the matter and energy of this world, why, as though you still belong to the world, do you submit to its rules?
See what a very interesting question arises when you... I mean, how much more impactful is that translation? So I prefer using it that way, because today, in 2016, if that's what the ancient Greeks were talking about, and the ancient Greeks, Paul is borrowing their terminology. This is their words that he's using. Paul's not ignorant of a lot of this stuff. He's no Aristotelian scholar, but he's certainly familiar with it from the Hellenistic side, and he knows how that normal usage would be. So somebody paraphrase what she just said. What's the paraphrase of that one?
Why do you obey false gods?
I think of it as this: if you have died to matter and energy, to the physical world completely, if you've died to the physical world, why do you still behave like you're bound by its laws?
Morpheus, is that air you breathe in?
I mean, this is borderline, if you take that translation, I don't translate Bibles for maybe what are obvious reasons now. If you take that translation, it's very much Matrix in some way. Now, Matrix is way off in other ways, but it asks the question of, are you just a physical person if you really are a spiritual being, then and spirituality, the immaterial part of you is the part that you really are, and you've died to the world. Now we have to figure out what he means by that. Is that literal or is that analogical? If you've died to the world, why do you keep acting like the world is what governs you?
I mean, so then what happens to render unto Caesar?
Right. So, good question. Now, what point is he addressing? Because the point of render unto Caesar, is what?
We are called by God to still follow and obey the laws of the land.
Okay, follow laws of the land because what? Why?
I mean, presumably because those are the people God put in charge.
Proper authority. Exactly right. So if you would follow the laws of Caesar, if he's a proper authority, who owns all the authority? Specifically, which person? All authority is given to me in heaven and in earth. Go therefore and teach all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and of the Son and the Holy Ghost, teaching them to observe all I have commanded you, and I'm with you always until the end of the earth. If Jesus is the proper authority, the source of the proper authority, and he says, follow, and who else backs this up? Says this elsewhere. Paul says it. Submit yourselves to the authorities who have been granted their authority by God for the execution of justice, etc. Jesus says, I put these governments in place, not because they're Christ-like necessarily, but because he has purposes for them. And so for that reason, you follow their laws. So the answer in this form of, if you're dead to the world where gold is part of what's going on, what does this say about that? How does this address it? So instead of saying, well, it seems to be opposed to it, try to put them together. What does it look like if you try to put them together? So kind of a dialectical approach of, if we think it all the way through and say, if really the question here is of authority, and God's the ultimate authority, and ultimately what we're supposed to do to authority is obey it, for what reasons we'll leave off for right now, but let's just say we're going to leave it at obey the proper authority. And he says, render unto Caesar what is Caesar's. Why did people not want to render unto Caesar what was Caesar's?
Because they liked to eat.
Okay. And ostensibly, an improperly enforced tax code leaves people with nothing to eat. A properly enforced tax code is like, takes everything right up to the point where you lose that last little bit that you're going to eat, depending on what the government is. But let's say that it's not quite that extreme. But what is it, ultimately? Let's say it's not for people, everybody can eat. Why do you want to keep your gold past that point, your drachma? The greed and a desire for material things. So why, as though you are not dead to the world, why, as though you're not dead to gold, do you continue to follow the natural order, which is people fight over, desire, and scrape for gold? So if you want to know how to make those two verses work together, it's not that the laws are there and we should ignore everything material. Obviously, we can't ignore everything material. Well, maybe you can. Maybe part of this means you can walk through walls. But that's not what it means, what it really means is, if you're contrasting the spiritual focus, none of which is material gain, and worldly focus, almost all of which is material gain, synthesizing what Christ says and what Paul's writing here has to do with, why are you acting like gold still matters? Why are you acting like your material gain is of any import at all? Why is that? Why do you act like that? You're dead to the gold. You're dead to this world. This world, this body, is nothing to you. It is a temporary rental space while you move on to the great place that you wish to, that God wishes you to be, and you wish to be in the long run. So that's one synthesis that I would offer up in answer to that one. Another verse that I would want to stick into this one and compare against this one is Jesus saying something that all of us read and we're like, that's amazing and awesome, and it makes me feel terrible about my own faith. What verse that Jesus uses in the Bible makes you feel worst about your own faith, makes you feel like it's your faith is so insufficient that it ought not be called faith at all, if you're like me? Did he say anything to you that was kind of discouraged? Did he say anything in response to somebody asking a question that you can think of that made you feel like your faith is too small?
Path of the righteous is narrow.
That one is kind of like probabilistically, where do I sit on that one? Yeah, okay, that one makes me sometimes scratch my head and be like, I hope I'm on the right path. What else? That's not the one I'm thinking of.
Give everything you have to the poor.
That one does, yeah. I admittedly turn around and say, I think that was a specific order for a specific guy with a specific problem at that time. So I quickly rationalize my way out of that one. But I tell you one I can't get around. How did you do this? The fig tree is withered. I think it's the fig tree is withered. I tell you truly, if you have faith as small as a mustard seed, which other places he says it's the smallest of all seeds. What he means is, locally speaking, that was the smallest seed, etc. If you have faith as much as a mustard seed, you can say what? You can say to this mountain, be uprooted and planted in the sea, and it will obey you. Now, I'm thinking, like, if your faith is this big, you can literally move a mountain. And I'm like, well, I literally can't move a mountain, so my faith is literally smaller than the smallest of all seeds. Now I'm looking to the atomists and being like, all right, what's the smallest physical construct I can come up with? Because maybe that's the size of my faith. Stoichia. If you are dead to this world, and God, now we think of we, let me tell you something that we think that the Greeks, ancient Greeks didn't, and the ancient Hebrews didn't. And we didn't think this until the 17th, didn't start to even think this until the 17th century. And it didn't really get ingrained until the 18th century. We think of the world, Christians think of the world, like this. A physical world and a spiritual world. And there's kind of two sides to it, and that you can, they don't necessarily affect each other and all that other stuff. This distinction did not exist at that time. The physical and the spiritual world are the same world. Absolutely the same world. There is one world that has some of the things in it have physical characteristics, and some of the things in it have spiritual characteristics. Now this, of course, just has to do with where you draw the line. Unless where you draw the line ends where the laws that govern it exist. What's the standing system of belief right now about how many laws there are that govern what we have going on right now? Flesh, atoms, elements, chemistry. How many physical laws are there? You should know this. I'm going to make you answer this one.
Oh, come on. How many? I don't even know what you mean by that.
Four fundamental physical laws, or three, depending on how you put them together. What are the four fundamental forces?
Gravity.
Yep.
Electromagnetic.
Yep.
Weak and strong.
Right. And some people think we have synthesized the electromagnetic and the weak forces. So there's an electro-weak force. Maybe you could, depending on whether you buy that or not. So three or four fundamental forces, and that these laws are so fundamental that every physical thing that happens can be explained in terms of those three or four laws. False. If you want to know how we talk about miracles as violations of the laws of nature. We talk about miracles as violations of the laws of nature because our worldview has nature here and spiritual stuff here. So everything that happens in here happens, and occasionally God reaches in from the spiritual world miraculously and changes something right there. What if that's not the way that it works? What if the way that it works is not full-on matrix, just if you realize it, then that there is no spoon, that all of a sudden now you can do it. But what if it's the case that the spiritual and the physical world don't work like that? When Jesus heals somebody, that healing somebody and casting a demon out, because everybody agrees that Jesus was an exorcist, whether the disagreement is whether there are actual demons to exorcise, whether he was actually doing it, or whether that was something else that was just psychosomatic and people were, reacting in that way. Ultimately, if this distinction doesn't exist, then we have dropped a significant part of natural science. Something interesting to think about. My principal skeptic is smirking, which means we have left out of our natural philosophy, out of our understanding of what comprises nature, we have left out, we might have, if this is the case. I'm not saying this is the case, I'm saying if this is the case. If stoichia, if Paul meant to use it in the same way that the ancient Greeks meant to use it, the atomist meant to use it, of the fundamental natural forces, if we are dead to those things, then why are we acting like they govern us still? This is another way of saying it is, if he means it in that way, if he's using it the same way as most commonly used in philosophy and religious writing at the time, another way of saying it is, if you're dead to the things that govern, if you're dead to matter, you're dead to, we say flesh. Flesh is a completely anachronistic term. It has been superseded by our now scientific lexicon, and it doesn't apply anymore. So when you read flesh, if you're not reading the word flesh the same way that you would read it in 1500, you're reading it wrong. That was when that term was meant to be used. When you turn around and say, if you're dead to matter, if you're dead to matter, why do you act like you're still governed by gravity, the electroweak force, and the strong force? That's another way of putting that verse, if you use that term. Now, that does sound a little, I admit, that sounds a little bit Matrix. But my point to you is this. How is Paul speaking in tongues? How is Paul healing the sick? How is Paul miraculously disappearing at times? How is Paul getting pulled out of prison, fetters falling off his hands? Now, if one of the answers might be, there's another set of forces out there. Now, you as Christians, if you believe everything, not everything, if you believe what the Bible seems to be saying principally, you actually already believe this. What force do you add? I'll give you a force you get add. So here's gravity, here's electroweak, here's strong, and hey, angels. These angels keep poking in occasionally, and they turn the key on Peter's leg irons, and they fall open. Now, we conceive of it in a way that says, well, in order for that to happen, an angel must take on a physical body, and then that physical body can interact via these first three forces with the leg irons. Maybe. You sure that that's the right model? Do angels' bodies ever not react in ways that seem to suggest that they're subject to these things? I just ask these questions so that you can go back and read through the scriptures as you do and ask this question of yourself. Am I reading a modern scientific mentality back into the Bible? And I'm not saying modern science is bad. I love microwaves. I love jet planes. I love all those kinds of things. It works. It works really well in some places. I think, as I've said before, we may have exceeded our brief when it comes to how far we extrapolate in those things. But ultimately, it's good. But you could be 3/4 of the way right and still be missing some key stuff there. So this almost even asks the question, why are you not doing miracles? And the answer, when you read all of Colossians 2 there, is because you don't think that this, and whatever else exists in there, you don't think that that's real. You think you're still governed only by these things, when in fact you're not. You have been given the word that we would use, we constantly use in the Christian lexicon, is power. Let me use another modern scientific term for it, force. You have a force, this kind of force, you have this kind of force that acts in ways that are not governed by these laws, if the Bible is true. Now, that's just to make you think a little bit more. So I don't want to go any further into the answering of this one, because I don't want to answer that question for you, nor am I honestly qualified to. But what I wanted to do is ask you questions that now you have to go back and figure out on your own through your own research, because if you're a solid grounder, a true solid grounder, this is what you do. You go back and you look for it more. Greg, and then...
Okay.
Yes.
On this
topic.
Your little topic is, in my experience, God is always moving us on planet Earth. He is under no constraints of physical or any other kind of law. Satan is always moving and doing stuff on planet Earth, and he's only constrained by God himself.
Okay.
Okay. If you go to other countries, you'll see demonic stuff happening all the time. You also see God moving all the time. My experience with, you asked the question, if miracles are not happening, why aren't they happening? Well,
no, I'm saying if people ask that question. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. My question is, are you obeying God? For example, many, many times I have seen people that were sick or had a problem. I said, can I pray for you? And they said, yes, please pray for me. They were not believers. God healed them on the spot. Why? Because I prayed. He answered the prayer. He's the one that does it. It's not me that's doing anything.
Right.
You know, I've seen many, many, many miracles. My father-in-law, for example, is right now in the hospital. He should have been dead a long time ago. They showed a picture of his arteries completely blocked. And God has miraculously kept him alive until he turned to the Lord and is now following Jesus.
So let me pause you there and let me address the two mindsets I imagine emerge when somebody in the class says this. There are, or at least two, but I'll highlight the kind of the ends of the spectrum. One is, yeah, that's right. You know, now I don't know if this brother's prayers exactly are the ones that are doing it, or if all the things he thinks are miracles, but ultimately, yeah, that's right. We ought to be able to do that. There's another end of the spectrum that's like, yeah, I appreciate it. He thinks it's genuine. This is psychosomatic. This is bias confirmation. This is kind of a selection bias as well. This is a whole bunch of other things. What's the atheist, for those that pay attention to these kind of things, what's the atheist's normal counter to God does medical miracles today?
Let's conduct a study. And you pray for group A.
You pray for group B, and we'll compare the rates of healing between the two, and we'll see whether prayer is an effective force. All right.
And they did that study.
And depending on who does the study and who interprets results, some of them are highly confirmatory of prayer. Some of them say that absolutely no difference. Some of them conclude that those for whom they were prayed did worse. Right. How do you get rid of the bias in the studiers, and how the study was conducted, and how is it that one conducts a scientific study in accordance with, if those forces really do exist, in a way that God would show up for them, which is the other automatic out on this one. But what's the drop mic walk away point the atheist brings up? If God heals people, I'll give you the first part of the sentence. Why doesn't He heal
everybody?
Some of them will say that one. What's the obvious one? If God does miracles, how come He never heals a blank amputee? So this one you hear a lot. Now, even when people say, "Well, He raises the dead," great. You know why? Why does an amputee seem to be a better test of God's miraculous power than someone being raised from the dead? Why do you think? Or do you think that would be the case?
There's no other reason that could be explained for it.
Right. We sometimes see people, I mean, we know stories back where we accidentally buried someone we thought was alive and they come clawing out of the ground. They're like, not dead yet. So, you know, is that resurrection or is that like just a suppressed physical state with low brain activity? Their heart, you know, is so blah, blah, blah. There's no physical explanation for why no hand. Right? Everybody admits, for anybody short of starfish, that doesn't happen. Is it the case that God never heals amputees?
No.
So this is the interesting point I would bring up to you. Craig Keener wrote a 2-volume book called Miracles, where he basically says, what if I don't assume the scientific bias, the naturalistic bias that says, when I encounter somebody that says, I prayed for my uncle got better, it's a miracle. What if I assume that that's not the case? How much evidence is, or this, you'll hear this question a lot, there's just no evidence of the supernatural. Dennis, who, God willing, will be back sometime, Dennis said, there's no evidence of the supernatural. Is that true? Keener walks around and he interviewed, his book is mind-numbingly sometimes academic. His 2/3 of the book, if you read the book, it's this thick, don't worry. You know how much you actually have to read? That much of it, 1/3 of it, because 2/3 of it are footnotes. And so if you look at a given page on one of these volumes, this much is text and all of these are notes below it. That's how much documentation he does in there. So his documentation goes all the way through history and says, where are the reports of miracles? What are the differences in between them? Which ones are pagan? Which ones are Christian? Which ones are legendary? Which ones are... And he does a really good examination of them. But the bottom line is, you can't own that 2-volume set and have read it, even cursorily, and say this, there's no evidence for miracles. Now you have to ask the question of, is there good evidence for miracles? Now you have to define what you mean by good evidence. And what his point is that he brings up in some of the first chapters of the book is, are you throwing it out automatically that it's possible that that happens? Or are you biased against it to such a degree that says, maybe miracles happen, but they have to be proven beyond some kind of Humean almost impossible, extraordinary definition in order to be considered true. Why is it that you think that the natural world is that miracles are unnatural? The ancient Greeks didn't think that. The ancient Hebrews didn't think that. In fact, most of the world doesn't think that. Do you know who thinks that? Modern Western society. Why do we in modern Western society say we've got this one right? We say, well, we've got better science, we live longer, we can make airplanes and rockets, and we live to be 90. Great, they live to be 100 in China.
Because science has become God in our culture.
And the idea is we give extreme authority to science. Do we give it too much authority? Back to what I had written over here. That's a question you're going to have to ask if you're going to look honestly at whether miracles happen or don't happen. Now, all I mean to say by that is this. There are many, many stories out there, people who will say, I saw this happen, where somebody had an arm cut off or a leg cut off, and it is miraculously put back in place. Now, whether you think they're credible or not, this is the question I would ask you. When somebody comes up to you and they say this, I just read a report that the Advanced LIGO facility detected gravitational waves. What do you ask for? Oh, that's very exciting. That's great. You don't even know who this guy could be. A friend. It could be a neighbor. It could be an associate at work. Somebody who you don't necessarily trust with your life, but you're like, all things being equal, I trust him or her. And what you don't doubt is that got reported. What's the second thing you ask? That's interesting. I'd like to know more about it. What do you want to see next? Is there a write-up of the results? Is there something, or sometimes maybe more easily, where's the YouTube video that explains this one? You know, and show me the thing. We watch it and we're like, okay, that happened. That's neat. So it looks like gravitational waves exist. That's our standard for believing something that is 100 years later. By the way, the discovery comes on exactly 100 years after what?
Einstein.
The public. Interesting timing. Okay, so I'm not saying that we were rushing to a conclusion on this one, but, and I don't know, I certainly haven't looked at it, but whenever you hear a scientific discovery, you wait 2 years at a minimum to say, does it work out? Because remember, bipolarization supposedly was proof of gravitational waves. This was 2 years ago or a year ago. And what have you heard about it recently? Did you hear them come back and retract it in the news? They never do.
It's very quiet.
Disappeared.
In the journal, if you follow it closely, but it doesn't get reported the same way any discovery does, because discoveries are amazing.
They're front new page news,
right.
Yeah.
It's fun. It's a good story. I can explain it. I can write it up. I can do it for, you know, kind of a layperson audience, and, you know, I can get my story published.
New York Times usually doesn't sell as many front page news as to say, rats, we were wrong about this again.
Yeah.
So bipolarization disappeared because it was wrong. Not that bipolarization is wrong. The detection of gravitational waves due to these things early time in the universe, false, didn't happen. Or if it did, we can't prove it. Whether the A-LIGO results will bear out over time remains to be seen as well. Very exciting, very interesting stuff. Good reasons to believe that they're there. Dual facilities, identically built. Very, very vast differences between the two, several microseconds of light travel. Not identical signals, but very similar signals, and signals that were theorized to have been generated by constructs that do happen from general relativity. So a lot of good positives why this could happen. The devil, not maybe literally, maybe you think literally, the devil's not is in the details in this one. Which, does anybody, I mean, we're getting a little bit off subject, but for my engineers and scientists in here, where is the actual sensing coming into place? Not actual sensing. What's the first level of interpretation in an experiment like this? Why did the bipolarization experiment turn out to be false? Anybody know? The signal-to-noise ratio on these kinds of things is so, so low that most of what you're reading is noise by several orders of magnitude. So your statistical models are actually what give you these results. So they'll tell you that here's, and I'm not doubting that this happened necessarily, okay? They'll tell you that this is the signal, and then you see something that should happen per Einstein's theory. This construct was built because of the software model that interprets the results. This might be entirely an artifact of programming. Now, the thing that's helpful, initially you're like, no, it can't be an artifact of programming. It showed up at both facilities. Both facilities running the same software? So your results are only as good as your assumptions, especially when your S to N ratio is that high. Now, all that being said, I think this might be a good result. I do think this might be a good result. I was very skeptical of the bipolarization stuff. This looks pretty good to me. And I'd say I'm 60% confident that one will bear out over time. 51% confident. So I won't be too wrong when I'm wrong. All right. Now, why do we talk about that? Well, some people in the class are interested in that. But aside from that, the reality of the forces that exist in this world, if the Bible is true, there exist forces, F equals MA kind of forces. And what I mean by that is forces that can affect this. Forces that can affect this that are not accounted for in any of our theories of natural law. Go ahead.
Keep going.
All right. Okay, so I'll leave that for you guys to explore a little bit because I do want to get to this next question. Oh, wow. Terrible job again. All right, so we'll at least frame the second question, unless there are follow-ups on that one that we want to spend on time here. Nothing immediately? Okay. What should church look like? Based on what you know about the early church, let's pretend we're just going to start with a quick hypothesis for the sake of time, because we'll do this in 10 minutes. Anybody believes that? Your credulity is way too high in this class. When you look at the New Testament, what are the things that ought to be in church? And we decide what ought to be in church by the things that they did. Let's make the assumption that Peter and the boys did and girls did what they were supposed to do. What does it look like? What are the foundations of church? What do you know?
Gathering of believers.
Okay, gathering. In what term? Yeah, I'll leave that term. All right. What else? Gathering. Okay. Frequent. What else?
Much smaller.
Okay. It seems to be smaller. Yep. Why do you? How's that justified? How do we know that?
Usually gathered at home.
Okay. Yep. All the time?
No.
Where else did we gather?
Went to the synagogue.
Went to the synagogues. We went to the homes. Where else did we go? Where did Peter and the boys teach? Solomon's portico, right? So that may not be church, but at least they were. Maybe that's just the outside preaching. Maybe that's where the amphitheater is. How many people were in Dorcas's house? Was it Dorcas's? Who fell? Whose house did somebody fall out the window of? Yes. Okay. So, but a house church. So maybe smaller. What else? What kinds of activities go on there?
Healing.
Healing. Okay. What else?
Prayer. There was a lot of discussion.
Prayer. Yes. Okay.
A lot of debate and discussion.
Okay. Yeah. Was there?
Yes.
Where?
According to the scripture, it says when you come together, everyone has a psalm or a hymn or everybody has something to say. It's not
okay.
Just one guy standing up and everybody listening to this guy.
Yeah, that's interesting. Do you know the passage he's talking about? Part of it is, sorry, go ahead.
1 Corinthians 14.
Yeah, and what's he doing? Why is he writing to the Corinthians and talking to them?
They were doing things the way they shouldn't have been.
He's saying you're doing church wrong. So if you're looking for whether you're doing church right or wrong, look at 1 Corinthians, because part of that letter is, hey, you guys are not doing what I told you to do. You're doing church wrong. Or you're not doing church you're doing church a worse way than a better way. And what did he criticize? What was this part? What was he criticizing specifically?
They didn't have a lot of accountability in the Corinthian church.
Right. Yeah, that's one way of putting it. It wasn't. Right now, we've got kind of like, when you go in there, clearly Mike's in charge, right? Mike or Ed or whoever's up there.
Their members, like they ought to have been.
Yeah, if you went to the First Corinthians church, you couldn't have picked out who a head pastor was because anybody was saying anything. So it's somewhere between everybody's the head pastor and one guy's the head pastor, but it doesn't seem to be either one of those. When I say head pastor, I mean roles-wise and where you were. Yes, that's right, too. That's right. So it has a group of elders, so we know there's elders or some governing body. Okay, what else?
Celebrated communion.
Did I spell that?
The Testament that they did.
Fellowship of the Ringway? Say again.
It seems like they celebrated communion, and it seems from the New Testament that they celebrated it on a weekly basis.
Yeah, and what did it look like? Was it crackers and...
A whole meal.
It was communion as a meal. What else? Okay, what else do we know was going on?
Prophecies.
Prophecy was happening. What else?
Is it fair to say there was a single unified church? Now, they were distributed, but there's a hierarchy, there's leadership.
Church universal, sure.
They were unified in the truth.
Well, but they, from an authority's perspective, in the apostolic age, nobody doubted that Peter and the 12 or the 11 were, Peter and the 10, I guess, the 11 were the guys. And now Paul does walk up to the guys and be like, you guys are wrong, and let me tell you why. And eventually they're like, nope, Paul's right. So it wasn't that the authority was unchallengeable, but if you wanted to throw the glove down, you went to the 12, to the 11, and you said, I'm throwing the glove down, you guys are mistaken about this.
Yeah, there's another thing that I think may be a little unclear, where in 1 Corinthians 14, it talks about if someone is sharing something with the group, paraphrasing, then you have something to share, then you interrupt, and the other person stops talking,
right.
and then a couple of verses later, I think it says, do all this properly and orderly, because God's not a God of confusion. And so I'm trying to think of, okay, so how does that work if someone's talking and whoever feels like they need to say something, they just start interrupting, and people are interrupting, but it needs to be orderly and proper. And
right.
So how to work that.
But this isn't, but even thinking about this question, though, I'm sitting, and think about it this way, I'm sitting in church and I get a word from the Lord. So what these guys were doing were standing up and being like, here's a word from the Lord, this is what I'm going to say. But what he said was, hang on and let the other person finish speaking. Think about the way that we do it at Rest in Bible. Not even a question, because that's because we don't do that at Rest in Bible. All right, what else was going on? We were missing something key here that were two. What were Peter, why? What else was going on that caused an initial course change adjustment that they had to do? We had these. What did we added another class. What did we add? Anybody remember? Say again.
Deacons.
Slaves, yeah. Well, yeah, I guess you could think of that way. Deacons. Servants. Deacons were there, okay. And what was their purpose? What were they there to do? What was the problem? Anybody remember what the problem was, the reason the deacons were clean? Yeah, so the Jews that were Greek-speaking and the Jews that were Hebrew-speaking, the Greek-speaking Jews came to the 11 and said, our widows are getting neglected in the daily distribution. What are you talking about? Well, you got to go back a little bit. It said in all their property they held in common, selling it as if somebody had more and somebody needed it. Okay, so some of it is, and don't say I'm Bernie Sanders by saying this, but this is what the Bible says. Physical monetary redistribution. Now, we do that here too, right? What do we call it?
Charity.
Yeah, we do. I mean, we give and then we have a benevolence fund or we have a whatever fund. So we do some of that here. I'm not saying we don't do that, but that was what was going on. It wasn't being done equitably. They came to the apostles and they said, somebody's got a rule on this. And the apostles said what?
We don't have time.
We don't have time for this because we should be doing what?
Preaching the word of God and doing the work of the ministry.
We need time. We are dedicating ourselves to prayer and teaching. And so somebody else must, some other responsible person must be put in charge of this. So teaching needs to be happening there. In fact, if you go to the Great Commission, go ye therefore and teach all nations. This is key. So if the church isn't doing this, then the church isn't doing the Great Commission, which has got to be somewhere close to fundamental, it seems. All right. Now, let me ask you this question. If you put all of those together, what kind of church looks like it's got it, quote unquote, the most right? Let's pretend that this was where the list stopped, and let's pretend that it's accurate, and let's pretend that it's kind of weighted the way that we talked about it. What types of church do these things?
Small groups.
Well, if you drew your box kind of like this, who does that look like?
Pentecostal.
Yeah. If you did this right here, maybe like this, what do you see? Where this is a weekly thing as well, drop the as a meal. Okay, that looks like the Catholic Church, doesn't it? And then if you said this, who looks like that right now? Yeah, okay, yes. Let's look at a little more Orthodox. RBC looks like this, okay? And who does this correctly?
Baptist.
maybe depending on how you want to model what your church looks like, you can say nobody or everybody. You know, gathering frequent might mean that's Bible studies, you know, Wednesday night Bible studies, or the Baptists do this really well, all right? Sunday morning, sometimes Sunday night if you're really dedicated, Wednesday night, and then you also have a Bible study. So if you're a Baptist, maybe you got that box checked better than some other folks do, at least in some of the Baptist churches that I had been. How about this one right here? Who does this?
Us.
You solid ground? They were the only guys who got that one right. All right. Okay. If these are the things that it looks like, what should church look like in 10 minutes?
Well, I'd say churches in the communist countries that are being persecuted look more like the scriptural model because they mean it homes, they don't, you know.
They don't have the option for cathedrals, they don't have the option for buildings like this.
The ability to do whatever they want to do.
All right, so let's say home churches is the right way to do it. Why did we build this building? Why did we put our money together and build this building at Reston? Why do you think?
We ran out of
room. We ran out of room for what?
People.
Okay, so if Pastor Mike Minter, what's his title at Reston Bible?
Teaching pastor.
That is a specific nod towards the scriptural idea of this is what the elders are supposed to be doing, teaching. Now, you can argue with whether that's the best way to do it, or whether it's that and a combination of that and this, or that and this and shepherd groups, or whatever it looks like. But the bottom line is that's an intentional nod to this. So that's why they did it this way, is they're trying to make the house big enough so everybody can hear the teaching. Now here's where the debate starts. Is it better to have one talented teacher teaching 1,000 people, some of whom are listening, some of whom are not, some of whom take his words and use them, and some of whom don't, because in a group that big you don't have any direct accountability? So what's the solution to that? RBC says shepherd groups is the solution to that. So what you do is you pull people in the shepherd groups, and you say the teaching that went on, and there was a phase in shepherd groups when they were basically doing this. Mike taught on X. What do we think about X? How are we going to apply X? All right, so that type of model was an intentional move towards saying, let's do this, the house church thing, correctly, while keeping it in line with good teaching. And why did we do that? Well, because we didn't want a bunch of, how do you have a bunch of shepherd group leaders? He teaches, he thinks one thing theologically, I think a different one, he thinks a different one. Each of us are teaching differently, and none of us are paying attention the way Mike's doing it. What does that look like? Looks like the Protestant church to the Catholic church being like, this is what happens when you just let everybody go off and teach their own stuff. You get 1,000 denominations, nobody knows what's going on. All right, come back to the church universal. That's the Catholic response to this. When you start debating, asking these questions, what you'll realize is there are really good reasons for every version of church out there you see doing what they did. Catholic, Orthodox, Protestant, Pentecostal, Baptist, all that other stuff. The difference is in how, what do you weight where? What do you weight? What do you value where? How do you order your priorities? And what do you think the best ways are to do that? Is it better to listen to a guy like Andy Stanley, who after you walk out of his amazing sermon, you're like, I got to do that. He's so right. It's so simple. I have to do it. And you know, so you almost want to do a study and say, given Andy Stanley's teaching and this, how many people actually apply it according to themselves and according to other people versus the way that we do it here versus the way we do it in a home church, that kind of thing. The only thing I'll note for you is this. If there's something missing off of this list, this is a partial list, if there's something missing off of this list, we're not doing it right. What's missing off of Reston Bible Church's list? This is not happening. This is not happening here. This is happening if you do it the way that the elders have asked you to do it, which is they've asked the church elders have asked everybody to be a part of a shepherd group, of which I'm not a part, by the way, so let me raise my hand and be like, I'm not even doing it the way RBC says to do it exactly right either. I kind of count this to be my group for now, and nobody's objected strongly enough to make me stop. But maybe I'm not right by doing that. We're not doing this right, or we're not doing this the way it was done back in the day, and we're not doing that. So, while I think we've got a lot right, Reston Bible, as a member of Reston Bible, as a teacher at Reston Bible, I'll tell you this, we don't have a lock on it. So don't let anybody tell you that if you're not doing it RBC's way, you're doing it the wrong way. False. Because we're missing some stuff that I can point to right now. The elders would, I imagine, tell you the same thing. They're not like, the RBC is a perfect model. What they say it probably is something like this. This is the best way we can figure out to do it in this society in which we live right now. But this may be a doctrinal theological difference here. You know, are the Pentecostals, quote unquote, right? Now, I've been to some Pentecostal churches where I walk out of it and I'm like, that was false, that was sketchy, I don't ever want to go there again, and maybe we'd be better off if those people didn't call themselves Christians. And I've been to some where I listen to something go on, I'm like, that seemed pretty legitimate to me. If I didn't automatically walk out and say, this can't happen. So, I'm not saying if you're not doing these two things that you're not a Christian, don't get me wrong. What I'm saying is, these are forms of things that were in the early church that are not in the church here. And it's something that we ought to at least consider as you're thinking about how to do what you want to do. Yes, Peter and then Sky and then...
How would we even do that? How would we even bring... I mean, I don't think anyone would be against having healing or prophecy.
We got 4 minutes left. Let's punt that question the next time. Because a long answer is required there. And maybe we'll start at least the next half of the class with what do we, if you were the council, what you get to be the 11. So this week, consider how to remake church into doing these kinds of things. And let me throw a further constraint on you and say it this way. You only can control Rest in Bible Church or people here at Rest in Bible Church. When I say control, you can only put your recommendations forth and expect that they would implement it. That way. If you had to operate under the constraints, how would you answer Peter's question? How ought we do this here at Reston? Okay?
So, I'm going to, like, if I reject the premise of your statement, as why do you automatically assume that the early church was right on every front?
Right. Yeah, all that assumes paleo, that that's the case.
This sounds like the paleo diet. Like, yes, the caveman automatically...
He had it right. How long did he live? 30 years. Great. Let's do that.
So are there things up there that maybe you go, yes, that applied at the time and place?
Okay, good point. So let's bring that up and say this. You don't, as you come in and think about that, you don't have to assume the early church was right. Now what you do have to assume is where God seemed to validate what they said with something that we think God would validate with it, you have to take that into consideration. A bunch of caveats on that too. But yes, that's a great point. Nat, I think I skipped you. And then, sorry, now I've definitely skipped you, but Nat first, and then
okay.
Yours was an earlier question.
You know, I think that some of the distinctions that you're pulling out there are things that we can do ourselves versus what is
yeah,
given to us.
Don't get me wrong, I'm trying to be provocative here, right? I'm not trying to make it, I'm not trying to smooth this over, I'm trying to show.
Prophecy and healing aren't from us, we don't control that, that's the Holy Spirit, or we're given the gift to be able to do that.
Yeah, great point. But now the question is, so somebody cycled this on Facebook, somebody from the Pentecostal side of the spectrum. It's got a picture, one of those normal, like, high, it looks like it was done in Vista color from, you know, 1930 or whatever. Pictures of Jesus teaching somewhere, maybe it's a Sermon on the Mount. And they've put in the kind of meme stuff that says, I want you to heal the sick, cast out demons, let the lame walk and raise the dead, but only for the first century. After that, hand out Bibles. So, you know, it's meant to make the point of... yeah, but is this supposed to be entirely absent now? And if the answer is no, yes, it is supposed to be entirely absent, good justification must be provided. And if the answer is no, it's not supposed to be entirely absent, where is this happening as part of the church or members of the church? And
well, I was just making the point that we can do certain things by feeding the hungry, but we can't invoke healing without, you know, higher power.
Yeah. Whoa, Seth. I so wholeheartedly disagree.
All right, so let that... Yes, let's have this debate next time because it must be had. But think about this debate prior to when it has so that more people can participate in it. But yes, brilliant question. Good to have a result to it. I know where you're going.
So what I'm looking at when I hear that, when you say the rest doesn't do healing prophecy or anything, you're thinking specifically of only physical healing.
Absolutely.
That's right. Like they are doing it because anyone who's brought into a relationship with Christ is given spirit.
So when I say that, let me walk back from that and say this. The way that it looked in the early church looks very different than the way that it looks now. Now, 3 weeks ago, I walked by, I saw one of the elders, and I said, my son is sick, pray for me. And he stopped me right there and he prayed, and the boy got better within the next 24 hours. Was it going to get better anyway? I don't know. But at the end of the day, I turned around and said, I know the methodology for this is I go to the elders, and the elders either anoint the person with oil, or that is symbolic, and it's not the oil that's healing, unless you're Catholic, in which case it's been imbued with the right things by the right authority to, you know. So, yes, does Reston do this? They think they do this. I think they do this. But they don't do it the same way it was done back in the day. So that's maybe what I really mean to say is that's not a part of church as a service. It's not a part of where we gather. Now, in this case, we gathered together. I saw him and line of sight, tasking and prayer. So that was kind of neat. But yeah, they do this. Now, I have yet to hear, now, occasionally a guy that comes through here will do this, but I've yet to hear anybody stand up and be like, Mike, I'm sorry to interrupt, brother. I have a word from the Lord. And he says, or she says, whatever she's going to say, right? So that did happen in the early church. It doesn't happen here. So I really mean to just, you're right, you're absolutely right, to draw an exaggerated dichotomy between the way it was done and the way that it's done today. Okay, these are very interesting topics to me. I think they're, because I think, like a child who has been told his whole life that he or she is not really good at anything, but goes to high school or college or gets their first job and realizes they really, really did have a hidden talent. They have something that they were meant to do. We are the same way. And most of us haven't found that. Because, fill in the blank with some of bunch of the reasons that I've already laid out and more that we'll talk about next time. But this is very exciting to me because it's about potential and realizing potential. Last comment and then we got a roll for the day.
Okay, I just wanted to throw out something. My wife was teaching four-year-old kids in a Christian school. And whenever a kid would fall down, she would teach all the others to pray. And some of the parents came back later and said that when somebody got hurt, they would pray. And people were getting healed.
Right.
From these little four-year-olds praying because they didn't know not to do that.
Not to do it, right. Haven't been taught not to do so. Now, let me... I'm not going to automatically be like, yep, that's right, because again, those are things you have to look into. And based on some of the Pentecostal churches I've been to, I'm not going to say just because somebody says that healing was done, it means that healing was done. Benny Hinn is on my list of if God ever gave me lethal authority to go after somebody. Benny Hinn's on my first. Okay, Roger.
And they saw things happen.
And some of the stuff is captured in Keener's book, so I recommend Keener's book to you. All right, one other thing I meant to add to this. This kind of thing right here, I had two I wanted to briefly talk about. That one and this one, maybe. These two right here are things that I think that we can do very easily. And I think people are really big about saying 10% of the church gives money to the church. 10% of the church is what supplies the whole thing. Maybe, because I know if you measured my giving by what came into Reston's coffers, you would conclude one thing. But my giving doesn't stop with Reston. It also goes to a bunch of other places, too. But not a bunch, some other places too. But there is some other stuff, like the verse that says, if you see someone who is hungry or unclothed, and you say to them, be warm, be filled, but you don't do anything for them, what does it avail you? So it's not just enough to pray for them, but if God has already equipped you to aid them out of your own resources, and back to the Caesar comment, and you're not been out of shape about gold, how hard is it for you to reach in your pocket and supply that person's need if you can supply their need out of your own pocket? It's like an automatic. You shouldn't even have to ask a question. Right? So if your attitude isn't that, you've got this wrong already. Now, if the person says, hey, look, I've just lost my house and my car, and I need $50,000, and you don't have $50,000 laying around, yeah, okay, and you're not, that doesn't mean you have to go sell your house, but what should you do at that point? Say again? That's where you go to the church and say, here's a $50,000 need. I can't source this myself. What does the church do? Now, this church in Northern Virginia, that's like not a day's worth of giving. That can be sourced from this church if it had to be, easily, by an aggregation of a bunch of people giving kind of thing. So just something to keep in mind. Wealth redistribution ought to be a part of your life. The Catholic is really good at this. The Orthodox is even better at this. They turn around after church. They say, church is helpful for me. And then I go out and do the work of the church. And they go find widows and hungry and all that stuff. And they take out of their own pocket and they provide for them. They're famous for doing this. That's the way you're supposed, when they do it right, they're supposed to do it. This right here, to me, is also really important. I mean, we all know that breaking bread together, we even use this. Hey, let's break bread with you, brother. That kind of thing. But why don't we do this? We should do this more. This doesn't, the communion doesn't, you don't have to wait for RBC to do communion. You can have your shepherd group do communion. You can have a group of believers sit around it. And if Jesus really said, as often as you get together, do this in remembrance of me, at Buffalo Wing Factory, when they bring out a basket of bread, you can break bread in remembrance of Jesus' sacrifice. Keep that in mind. All right, I went way over on time. Thank you for the time and attention. Send more questions into the Facebook page. Obviously, I was like, we only have two questions. Well, it wasn't enough time to cancel, to cover them. But thank you, Steve. Thank you, Peter, for the questions. And we'll see you next time, hopefully. God willing.